I cannot recommend everything in the heist movie, of course, but in Ocean's 11, Danny Ocean surprises his ex-wife in a restaurant. He shows up. She wasn't expecting him. He sits down. They start talking. She says, "You know what your problem is?" And he says, "I only have one." If I only had one problem, it would be anger. It developed, I would not say matured. It developed in my early 20s. It's not that I was never angry before that, but my dad was mostly angry enough for the whole family. So I just wanted to avoid the fallout of his fury. But when I started living away from home on my own, I continued the family business of getting mad and really started getting good and mad about a lot of things. Mo has never been blind to it, and in fact, she has certainly borne the brunt of it. I did not really even start to reckon with it until I had already professed Christ, been baptized, thought I was called to the ministry, graduated from Bible college, graduated from seminary, had a full-time vocational job as a pastor, and then when Calvin was about 18 months old, he was such a little angry, tiny tyrant. He was mad about everything, and that made me mad. We had to actually stop taking him out for a while. We knew we had to go to church because I was getting paid to be at church. And then obviously we lived at home. But we stopped really taking him anywhere else because inevitably Mo or I would end up in the van with him screaming about something he was mad at while everybody else finished their fun or their food, you know, in the restaurant or wherever it was. Then I read a short blog post. I think it's a max two paragraphs. I read a short blog post about adversarial fathers who are teaching their sons how to respond. And by God's grace, it finally hit me that I was the one who was showing Cal how to respond to things he didn't like. I was the one who was showing him to get mad when something was happening that I didn't like. And he was just embodying that as an 18-month-old. It turns out my childish temper tantrums were the problem, and I didn't even have the excuse of being a child. I repented. I kept repenting. And also, by God's grace, I had opportunity to be up close to a couple of the people in my life that weren't repenting from various sins, and I saw the destruction that anger, whether it's the loud kind or the quiet seether kind? Both ends of the volume spectrum. The kind of destruction that anger causes. Proverbs actually has some very plain teaching about anger, but interestingly enough, I want to start in Ecclesiastes. There is not only same author, but a short, pithy summary statement in Ecclesiastes about anger that I think is appropriate to start with. "Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools." Angry men, even the ones who are trying to defend their wisdom, they are actually demonstrating themselves to be the fools. The King James translates it as, anger resteth in the bosom of fools. Men can also be very bosomy. But metaphorically bosomy with bitterness and anger. And it's not a good look. You could contrast that with Proverbs 14, verse 33, which actually says that wisdom rests in the heart of a man of understanding. And when wisdom is resting in the bosom of a man of understanding, he makes himself known even among fools. So he actually distinguishes himself from fools when it's wisdom that is resting in his heart, in his bosom, in his chest. In English, the word anger means a strong feeling of annoyance and displeasure or hostility. And I give the dictionary definition of anger because lots of angry men like to plead the dictionary. Oh, I'm not angry. I'm just irritated. I'm not angry. I'm just frustrated. I'm annoyed. And sure, there could totally be shades of meaning that allow for some cover, some hiding. But in general, it's a bad spot when you have to use the dictionary to prove to someone that you're not mad. Arguing about how you're not angry is like trying to convince someone to focus on the smell of the air freshener in the porta potty. You have already lost at that point. Anger is a fool's affection. It is a kind of reaction, attitude, feeling, emotion that even has physical effect at times, red cheeks, loud mouth. If you look in Proverbs chapter 25, verse 33, it refers to receiving angry looks. My wife would describe them as dead eyes. The kind of stare that would be hurting, killing the other person. The stare could accomplish that. The thing I hope to argue tonight is that the antidote to anger is actually not no feelings, but getting our feelings to submit to what is true, right, and real. It is not avoiding feelings. It is getting our feelings and our affections directed and matching what is true and right and real. To say that an angry man is a fool obviously means that he is not wise. And what is it that keeps a man from being wise? What keeps a man stranger to wisdom is when he is not fearing the Lord. And so we perhaps need to do a better job of connecting our failure to fear the Lord with how we end up in a response of anger. I've been thinking about the objective nature of the world for a few months. How many things there are that are actually real and unchangeable by us. Things that are not subjective, things that are not relative, things that don't depend on my attitude or my view of them, things that are just there and they're real, they are objective. I started thinking about it while brainstorming for a rhetoric class that I was going to be teaching, and was thinking about how rhetoric often hovers around the discussion of beauty. Rhetoric is a persuasiveness, technically, capital R rhetoric is persuasiveness with words, but there can be a lowercase r kind of rhetoric, a persuasiveness of one's life as well as one's word, or persuasiveness in various kinds of artistic forms. But usually rhetoric is hovering around this discussion of beauty, whereas truth and goodness get to ride the rails down on the ground of objective standards. Truth, goodness, and beauty, truth and goodness get down on the ground. They're the nitty-gritty, they're the unchangeable, but somehow the beauty gets to be more in the eye of the beholder. Beauty often floats in the wind of subjectivism. And obviously it's true that beauty may be varied, but actual beauty is not dependent on the beholder or the listener. There are things that make beauty attractive and appealing. There are things about beauty that make it smell good. So I was thinking about this objective reality and about how even in a subject such as rhetoric, what do I need to understand in order to persuade somebody to my position? And should I be confident that I'm not just trying to persuade them into a position that I feel is better than the position that they feel that they're in? Could I have confidence that there is a good rhetoric way to persuade someone and have confidence that what I'm persuading them into is also right, not just I like it better? So we read at the beginning of the school year, The Abolition of Man. The Life to Life leaders are reading The Abolition of Man. The Abolition of Man is the prose version of That Hideous Strength, which the ladies are reading as a novel in Titus 2. The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis is a sustained screed against the skull and crossbones of subjectivism, the poison of it all just being about what, as an individual, I like or don't like. The Abolition of Man is a prophetic word against the meaninglessness that follows when there is no objective, external, transcendent standard, something for us to actually hold on to, that can be measured, that we can enjoy, that we can submit to when necessary. And when you get rid of external standards, Lewis describes that all you end up being left with is wants. It's just likes and dislikes. So all of us actually have loves and affections. There is also in the world that God created what, for lack of a better title, and for lack of a better shape, squares a good solid external objective thing, right? Sure. It's got lines. Got dependable angles. So obviously the world is not square. But in terms of the objective things, the things that matter, they exist in a reality of values. Within the reality of values, there are things that matter more than other things. But that's according to the reality of values. So the reality of values has the spectrum of better and less better. That's included in the reality of values. But in particular, it means it's not subjective. What we have today are a bunch of people who have decided to either ignore or actually try to destroy the reality of values, and all they have left outside of that is their wants. And do you know what happens when you're driven by your wants that aren't actually connected to any reality of value, anything valuable that's true, when all you have is your wants, and those wants actually don't match with what is actually valuable, though when you don't get your wants, what do? You get angry. The culture that we are living in, for at least a number of decades probably, has been trying to build their culture on the reality of values without talking about where those reality values came from, namely from God. They tried to keep the values without the source of the values. Now, because we've been denying the source of the values for so long, we're so practiced at that, now we're actually trying to destroy reality. We're trying to destroy the value in being male or female. We're trying to destroy the value in a husband and a wife making up a marriage. We're trying to destroy the value of certain kinds of education. Because all we got left is our wants. And we have turned from a sort of ignorance or willful ignoring of the reality of values into a trying to destroy them and attack them. That is what we want. These things that exist in the reality of values are keeping us from what we want. A wise man is actually going to recognize what God has made and what is true and what is right, and actually going to seek to get himself in line with that. He is going to seek for his affections to more and more match what is really valuable. A wise man is a man who fears the Lord. It is the Lord who has given the reality. It is the Lord who defines for us the values within reality. So when we are fearing the Lord, yes, we revere his value. But when we are fearing the Lord, we are also receiving his valuations of things. In real time, here on earth, in our relationships, our interactions, our setbacks, our successes. Someone who fears the Lord obviously is recognizing that the Lord is the most valuable, but then they are also receiving from the Lord as Lord. You want to fear the Lord, then you receive from him what he says is valuable when he gives it, when he defines it. It turns out he's quite a generous giver of valuable things in reality. He is a giver of good gifts, including a wife is a gift, Proverbs 19:14. Grandchildren are a gift, Proverbs 17, verse 6. Wealth in the right place from wisdom is a gift, Proverbs 18:18, and more. Not only does the Lord give some of those things we more immediately acknowledge as valuable, but the Lord even is in charge of the roll of the dice, according to Proverbs chapter 16, verse 33. The lot is cast into the lap, and it is from the Lord. He gives even the cast of the dice. It is the Lord who, in the reality of values, enables us to expect what happens when you watch a lazy man keep being lazy. It is inside the objective reality that a person who continues to be lazy will have their walls broken down and thorns growing up over top of their property. That's in the reality of values. That is objectively dependable. In the reality of values, we learn that the Lord makes it happen so that relationships are ruined when people whisper about each other. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 28. Those gossipy whisperers end up separating friends, whether themselves from a friend or some other combination of friends. A wise man lives according to reality. A wise man who is fearing the Lord of the reality of values, a wise man doesn't resist that reality. He does not try to make up his own. So therefore, a goal of our instruction is to give knowledge and understanding about how things work in the Lord's world. When people call wisdom, when they define wisdom as skillful living or skillful application, I think that that is fine. But I would like to add to that, wisdom is also skillful submission to the reality of values that the Lord has given. And the reason why we get angry is because we won't submit our affections to what the Lord has given. We are not skilled in submitting to what is genuinely, objectively right and valuable. This is what enables wisdom to include hating evil. Because in the reality of values, evil deserves to be hated. Hating evil and pride and perverted speech, Proverbs 8:13. a strong negative affection, because evil deserves a strong negative affection. Wisdom laughs at the chronic know-it-alls who are sure that the crash won't come to them until it actually does come to them. Proverbs 1, verse 26. That is how it works. A wise man wants his heart and his affections to match. He wants his affections, his feelings to submit and then fit in with the reality of values. Getting wisdom is getting a better fit between our affections and the values, matching and ordering our loves to what is really lovely. We love this, not that. We love this more than that, because that is what is true. An angry person is building sandcastles on the wing of a plane at 30,000 feet going 700 miles per hour and writing negative reviews of the pilot. That is an ignoring, if not a despising, of reality. An angry man thinks he knows better how things should work, and he either forgets or denies or attacks reality as given by the Lord. Road rage. A rage against how many cars are on the road. And as one who has sat in Los Angeles traffic, almost 5 years worth of Los Angeles traffic, thinking, yeah, Friday at 4:30 on the 405 down to the airport should be really fast. Now, who is the fool at that point? Who's resisting reality? The man, the driver, the road rager. When you get dyspepsia about when the food gets put on the table, the reality, according to me, is that 6:01 is too late. Wow, what a selfish, non-submitting kind of attitude that is. The tone of voice in the kids' "yes, sir" makes dad testy, as opposed to grasping that the last half hour of conversation has led to that tone of voice in the kid, because more than likely your own tone of voice has pushed them into that. At heart, in the bosom and the chest of the angry man, he wants reality to bend to him. And that is the thinking of a fool. One thing I noticed while gleaning the field of Proverbs for wisdom about anger is not just how many times anger is mentioned, which is 12 by word count, but how many of those mentions about anger in the book of Proverbs is part of a phrase that includes being slow to anger. Not just how many times anger is talked about, but how many times it talks about the one who is slow to anger, which actually is the opposite of Ecclesiastes, which we looked at the beginning, the one who is quick to have a temper. Proverbs 14:29, this is the one that is on the kids' corner. If you want to help your kids start grasping how their affections fit into the reality of values, showing them what is actually foolish, this is a good one to memorize. Whoever is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who has a hasty temper exalts folly. What does that mean, to exalt folly? It means to throw folly a big anger party and say, look at this folly. Gather round, everybody. Oh. If anybody would have been bold enough to challenge my anger in my house. That's what it would be like, right? It's like your voice gets louder, not just to communicate the intensity of the displeasure of what the other person has done, but it's like you want everybody to come and see and watch the show. Let us really, I mean, let's not do this folly thing at like a 2 out of 10. Let's ratchet this baby up. Let them remember the night that I was angry like this. The one who is hasty in temper exalts folly. This is true in terms of providence. The events, the situations that the Lord gives to us. It is also very true in interactions with persons. Good sense makes one slow to anger, and it is his glory to overlook an offense. Now, this is not just a inanimate kind of thing that has happened. This is another person who's got a face and they're using words against you. When criticized, fairly or not, when mocked by someone else, in fun or not, here's how wisdom shows glory. Whatever. Now that is not the books I have on how to show your glory when you got the insults coming at the angles. You know, you're going to get the power stance. Come at me, bro. You think you're clever in your criticisms. Watch this. Solomon actually says, that is not glory, and it's not wisdom. So, you'd be slow to anger because someone has come to give an offense. Let's say that their comments about you and to you are false. Why would you get mad? It's false. All right. Let's say that they come and their comments and their criticisms are true. Well, why would you get mad? They're true. All right, you got me. Siblings. Glory to overlook the dumb thing your brother or sister said. Spouses. Look, somebody has to go first in at least getting a little bit more glory than the other person, which will actually irritate the other person because then they'll, if they're thinking at all, they'll be able to see, oh, wait a second, they're getting more glory than me because they're not freaking out about it. And so they'll push harder to spoil your glory, to get you to spoil your glory. Either way, what they say is false and isn't going to stick, or what they say is true and, like, here we are. Either way, it should take more than a comment to knock your joy train off the tracks. Whether it is face-to-face or on Facebook, getting angry shows who the fool is. Even if you are technically right, the not being slow to anger shows no glory. Good sense makes one slow to anger. You hold on to the reality that it's false or that it's true. You hold on to the reality that'll be part of your glory, which is going to make you a non-starter. So you end up being an empty box of matches. I previously have given an illustration when it comes to people who are bringing gossip to you about being a wet lump of bread dough. And they have their match. They want to get a fire going. You be a wet lump of bread dough. non-starter. Who is going to get a match lit off of you? The match is going to get sucked in like Ehud's knife into Eglon's belly. That's what you want to be like when other people are coming at you. You have my permission to think of yourself as King Eglon, the big fatty. And those little daggers are just coming right in. Now, it did kill Eglon, so that's where the metaphor breaks down. This is not going to kill you. A hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger quiets contention. This is not just you walking into a party where everybody is punching each other. This can be at your dinner table when there's only one other person. It's not quieting contention in terms of some big crowd. That can happen, but it can also happen just between you and another. A man of wrath, Proverbs 29:22, stirs up strife, and one given to anger causes much transgression. Democratic cities, by democratic I mean the democratic cities that have a bunch of people who vote for the Democratic Party, literally were burning themselves down a couple summers ago. Angry. Institutions, households, generations are set on fire. Anger leads to other sins. I thought of a couple just quickly. Anger can lead at least to the sin of slander, because you're so angry at somebody else that you slander them to make them look bad rather than yourself, or that's what you are hoping is going to happen. Anger can lead to laziness, actually, to avoid taking responsibilities for your own problems. You're trying to deny the reality of values and that you are to blame. So leads to being a sluggard. When we get angry, we are not only self-referential, meaning that we have put ourselves in the center of things and are constantly referencing ourselves. When we get angry, we're not only self-referential, we are self-reverential. We are communicating how not right we think it is that someone is not fearing us. And take a throne then that does not belong to us. When we get angry, we are demanding glory, reverence, without actually exhibiting it. So the fastest to throw an adult fit does not make a person worthy of respect. It actually makes us vulnerable. I am indebted to a sermon by Doug Wilson from a few years ago on the subject of self-control, in which he spent his time exalting self-control while targeting the sin of anger, as opposed to other things we often connect with needing self-control for, like lust or gluttony or laziness. But Wilson compares the angry man to one who is pushed around by the circumstances. An angry man is one whose nerve buttons are big and accessible and have a very sensitive trigger. He is like a man whose walls are broken down, which comes from Proverbs 25, verse 28. A man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls. Wilson says, quote, "You should want walls like Babylon had, where four chariots could drive abreast around the top of them." Now that's a wall. You got four chariots in a race, side by side on the top of a wall. That's a wall. A man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls. Where does that kind of self-control come from? I think that it comes from the stability and strength of living according to reality. The angry man is defenseless in a couple ways. He's defenseless in terms of not living according to what is true, and he is defenseless because he's left vulnerable to further attacks. He's got walls like Jericho. The angry man has a city on the, after the trumpet band has played and all the big stones have fallen. In a lot of ways, the way of the modern world deceives us. We can get tempted even by certain kinds of technology and by certain sort of comforts that, if not held in the right way, tempt us to manipulate our annoyances out of our way. And in so doing, we learn the habits of impatience and habits of blame rather than of taking responsibility. If you went out, and we've lost the agricultural connection because it's not the same thing going to the Safeway, but if you could go out and watch a farmer at the end of June yelling at the ground, shaking his fist at the seeds that weren't sprouting fast enough, you would think that the farmer was mad. You would not think that he got bad seed. You'd be like, dude, you put this in the ground a few weeks ago. That's not how seeds work. You are crazy. You need to go maybe have some lemonade. Just relax a little bit. A farmer would be an obvious fool for getting angry like that. Maybe he could get angry at God for God's choice of the weather. But when we think that we can control the things that are irritating and annoying us and get them out of the way through some kind of technology, or we'll just pay to fix it, we end up becoming angry little impotents. Impotents as those who are resisting, those who are rebels, which is the same thing as making us little devils. It was Satan who wasn't willing to submit in his God-given lane. He thought of himself too highly and lost it all. He is still a fool resisting the reality of values. It's not that he doesn't know them, it's that he doesn't want them, and that makes him mad. So James said, "Know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God," because it doesn't fit in the box. It's not according to how things work. You don't yell somebody into their being quiet to accomplish at least a quiet room. You are the one who messed that up. So take a step back. Take a breath. This is not Serenity Now, but it is trying to get ourselves to remember, okay, wait a second. What's happening here? What is God doing here? What does he want from me right now in this moment? How is the way that I care for and show that I care for this person I say that I care for? Your life is bigger than any situation you are in. And the person that you're interacting with, their life is also bigger than that particular moment. You are an eternal creature among other eternal creatures, which makes the situation very serious. But we miss what is serious about the situation. What is serious is whether or not I fear the Lord. It doesn't matter what else. What matters in the moment is, will I submit to what he wants from me right now, or will I be a fool? And the fool's ways are to get angry. Slow to anger is all right, let's think about this. Let's process it. Let's get that you're not actually my enemy, which is the point of the adversarial father's article, even about our sons. If your son is an enemy, then yeah, fight. If your son is your son, then fighting him is potentially not what is going to be helping him. So again, something is very serious in every situation. What is serious is whether we will obey. It can also be serious whether our kids are obeying. It can also be serious if the person that we're pursuing who's in sin repents. I'm not saying that those aren't additional serious things, but the most serious thing is that I am fearing the Lord, I am obeying, I am not being a fool. Imagine you could look in at what's happening to yourself from 100 different windows, as opposed to your little personal peephole that has got you stuck on the issue. Like, try to look at it from some other sides. Perhaps even from the Lord's perspective. A wise person isn't seeing something that isn't there. A wise person is seeing better what's there. A wise person is seeing better what is valuable. A wise person is better at seeing the constraints. Not that he doesn't see the problems. He sees the problems in their right context. Anger is what keeps the algorithm sucking you into the timeline by showing all of the problems with no context. They are algorithms of anger removing, trying to keep you from bringing any perspective to it. Oh, can you believe that? See it. Be slow to anger. I don't know a lot about the human body. I pay professionals to tell me things. But you cannot flex your bicep and your tricep at the same time. It just doesn't work. You can only do one or the other. Now, the problem with the illustration is that both the muscle groups are actually valuable. They're both useful, unlike what I'm about ready to compare. But you cannot flex your anger and your thankfulness at the same time. You would think that some of us have a version of 1 Thessalonians 5:18 that says, be angry in all circumstances. Or some monkish translation of Ephesians 5:20, be angry always and for everything. But of course, what those verses actually say are, be thankful. Well, how could I be thankful for this? Well, maybe if you gave it more than 5 seconds, you could come up with something. Be slow to anger. Give it a shot. Just try. If your thankfulness muscles have atrophied, no problem. It's required. So pray to the Lord for help. Thank you, Lord, that you have exposed that I try to get angry about everything when I should be giving thanks for these things. So please help me be slow to anger until I can get the thanks part going. Practice the thanks. You will have a hard time maintaining rage against a person. You can bullet point out 5 things I'm thankful for. By the third one, you're like, all right, this is from the Lord. I do love you, you idiot, kind of thing. This is not the same thing as stoicism, which is suppressing feelings. This is not the same thing as sophistry, which is some kind of argument, some kind of fallacious argument, some kind of mind trick. It is actually replacing the wrong affection with a right one. It is getting our affections into the square, the reality of values. It's fearing the Lord as Lord. Now, what about righteous anger? And, of course, that's what we all really want to know, because my anger is the righteous kind, clearly. I do believe that righteous anger is an appropriate category. I don't have exact Pew Research study data on this, but I think it is probably misclaimed 90%+ of the time. I think it's an actual category. I think that, you know, because it's only going to be Christian people who are talking about it, because they're the only ones that would think about adding righteous to anger in the first place. There is a righteous anger that in Mark chapter 3, verse 5, it says Jesus was angry with them because the religious leaders were giving grief about him healing a man on the Sabbath. They were focused in on the detail of the when it happened. Jesus had a much larger context on, he just got healed. You guys are mad about this? So he was angry in return. Jesus was angry. We know that Jesus didn't sin. We know that we are supposed to be like Jesus. So if I put all those things together, I am satisfied with there being the possibility that we could be like Jesus and be angry in righteousness on his behalf. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26, it does actually say, be angry and do not sin. There's questions about how to understand that. I think also in Ephesians chapter 4, you would find that what came before in context are some people who are hurting others, not those who are being hurt themselves. So, is it possible to be righteously angry, to say, Jesus, I am just trying to be angry like you in this moment? That I do think that that is possible. I think that, especially for men who have a long history of being non-righteously angry, that they better be pretty careful about, oh, no, no, I know that this one, no, that one wasn't, but this one definitely is. Well, maybe. Anger dwells in the bosom of fools. Your sex life will not be better because you're more angry. Your kids will not grow up and be more well-adjusted because they survived the gauntlet of you and your anger. Your neighbors are not going to see your good anger and glorify God on the day of visitation. Anger is a destructive folly, and it is a defenseless one. There is no good reason according to what is true, and it opens up to further criticism. Angry men are usually defensive men, not because there's something worth protecting, but because of desperation to make it appear that there is something worth protecting. Losing one's temper is the same thing as unveiling one's ego. Emotional regulation is arrogance regulation. It is wise. The wise men fear the Lord, and that wisdom is a skillful submitting to him and to what he has given. And it is kind of interesting that when we are slow to anger, that is when we are ready for the right kind of fight. And that's when we're ready to fight well. Proverbs 16:32, whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. You are actually ready to be a warrior when you are slow to anger, when you are not overwhelmed with trying to micromanage somebody else to stop annoying you, and when you are in control of your own heart and your own feelings. I am very thankful to a number of friends who have disobeyed the wisdom in Proverbs 22, verses 24 and 25, which says, don't associate or be friends with a man given to anger. I am thankful for the friends who have disobeyed that wisdom and who have helped me learn new ways. I have heard recently a story going around about some kids who are now adult kids saying that they never once saw their dad get angry growing up. And sadly, my kids will not be given that testimony in any podcast interviews they do someday in the future. But perhaps the next best thing is that I've had to preach this message while they listen. And of course, my kids have to listen to me preach week after week, whatever it's about. And so far, by God's grace, they're not running away because they're seeing God continue to work. So that is some accountability. That is some encouragement. Let us be slow to anger and growing in our wisdom, fearing the Lord and receiving what He has given, that we would be skillful in our submitting. And very skillful, I think it is a skill that you can improve on. Very skillful in giving thanks. You're not going to be angry when you are abounding in thanksgiving. Let that be true of us. Father, thank you for the wisdom in your word, the opportunities that we had to consider it, the opportunities that we do have to repent and grow up and honor you more as you then change us into the image of your Son. Let us have the kind of affections that he had, that we would receive your will for us, that we would love what you say is lovely, that we would submit, we would be thankful in all things and just not mad. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.